Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
A lot of people have a great deal of trouble sleeping.
And around 1 in 10 of us will have clinically diagnosable insomnia, so that is 3 or more nights of sleep interrupted per week, such that it affects your day-to-day functioning, and that's been going on for 3 months or more.
I talked with Dr. Simon Erich of Curaleaf about using cannabis-derived medicines to help with this. We discuss an awful lot, including do these medicines work, and what is the proof? How do they work? Do they continue to work after some time of using them? Who can use them? And are there some people who really shouldn't use them? And much else. So please do join me for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
I really enjoyed my chat with this week's guest, Dr. Simon Erich. My first question to him was, is the title doctor, does he use the title doctor because he's a medical doctor, an MD, or because he has a PhD?
I am an MD and I'm almost a PhD. I just need to submit it.
Do you know, I've been told that story before. My wife has a PhD. I just need to submit it. Yeah, that can go on a while.
It can go on a while. But I've still got a year left to submit it within formal guidelines, but you know these things can always be pushed, but I'm hoping not to push it. I finished up all the research, so it's just about putting it down on, I was going to say paper, but on a laptop screen, I guess.
All right, so when are you hoping to get that finished by?
Well, submitted in between September and December of this year.
Okay, I'm going to give you a call. I'm going to send you a message. Say how you're doing.
Good.
All right, well, look, good luck with that. We might talk a bit more about what the PhD is on, but let's move on to the topic of sleep, first of all. Now, everyone sometimes kind of has a bad night's sleep and doesn't sleep very well and sort of feels grumpy the next day. But some people are really suffering, and it's a lot more than just the odd bad night's sleep, which we all have. Do we know how many people sleep badly and it's not just the odd night's sleep? You know, it's a real problem for them.
Yeah, of course. I think sort of the official statistics around this is that around about 1 in 3 of us will have symptoms of insomnia, and around 1 in 10 of us will have clinically diagnosable insomnia. So that is 3 or more nights of sleep interrupted per week, such that it affects your day-to-day functioning. And that's been going on for 3 months or more. Obviously, not everyone is going forward, you know, to their GP or to you know, other experts to receive help for that. That's the sort of well recognized figures for sleep disruption in the UK.
So this is a lot of people. This is not a
small exactly.
problem. And what one of the things that I don't know if it surprised me, but I hadn't really thought about it before through reading the press release, is that people that suffer from a lack of sleep, their insomniacs, it can make other conditions worse.
Entirely, and there's actually probably a bit of a negative two-way cycle there. So if you want to take the most common condition where medical cannabis is prescribed, like chronic pain, for example, people with chronic pain often have their nights interrupted due to the significant amounts of pain that they may be in on a day-to-day basis. That then wakes them from their sleep, unable to get back to sleep, and that's disrupted. But then throughout the day, because of that disruption in their sleep, that makes them more aware, more focused in on their aches and pains that are associated with whatever is causing that chronic pain for them. And subsequently, you have that negative cycle whereby the next night of sleep is disrupted and they're feeling worse pain the next day, and so on and so forth.
I suppose pain is quite an obvious one, because it's you can imagine being hard to get to sleep if you're in pain. Are there any other problems that people get exacerbated that might not be so obvious?
That's a good question. I guess I'm depends what you mean by obvious. Mental health conditions obviously are ones where which may come to mind, particularly anxiety related conditions, whereby those individuals may have a tendency to ruminate on certain things throughout the day. And that particularly, I think all of us, even if you don't have an anxiety disorder, will recognize sometimes as you're getting towards that last hour before bed, your mind starts worrying, you start having difficult conversations with your partner or whoever else is with you, which you probably should have had much earlier in the day. And so for people with anxiety disorders or other mental health conditions, that can certainly be exacerbated. But it can be, really across the spectrum. So I guess a good example, something maybe less commonly thought of, but is a common reason why medical cannabis is prescribed, is for epilepsy.
All right.
We know that people with sleep disruption, if their epilepsy is not well controlled, are more likely to then go on and have a seizure. And obviously, the impacts of then having a seizure then may therefore make their sleep poorer for the
Yeah.
next following days. So that's
I
probably
can see
maybe.
how there can be a vicious cycle involved in a lot of these. All right, so let's sort of move on a little bit to what we can do about it, because there are an awful lot of sleeping medications that can be prescribed, herbal teas, all kinds of stuff to help people sleep. So what's the problem? Are these not working?
I mean, fundamentally, yes, is honestly the answer. I think we have to constantly be churning over to try and find new answers to our armory in helping people to sleep. There are obviously really basic things that we can all do to try and help with our sleep, things that people call like sleep hygiene, for example, whereby reducing screen time before you go to bed, trying to restrict the time that you're spending in your bedroom to just that time when you are intending to sleep, making sure you have regular bedtimes and wake up times and things of that nature can all be really helpful. But for many people, particularly those who have true insomnia disorder, that's not going to be sufficient in and of itself. So the first line for that would be cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So you're incorporating some of that basic sleep hygiene, but more trying to reprogram people's thoughts around sleep, trying to break the anxiety of going to bed and potentially having a broken night's sleep, and how to change sleep patterns to promote sleep throughout the night.
I think something that's worth getting across, and I mean, I don't suffer from a sleep problem at all. I'm really lucky. I go to bed and I go to sleep in just in seconds sometimes. But just trying to get across how awful this is for a lot of people that do suffer from poor sleep. It just affects, it just can ruin their life practically.
Yeah, 100%. I think, insomnia, just like any other physical and mental health condition, really has the potential to ruin someone's lives. And I think, much like many people, I think things have improved massively around sort of stigma around mental health conditions, for example, because any of us at any time live across a spectrum of how much anxiety we feel on a day-to-day basis, or maybe we have some low mood or whatever it may be. There comes a point whereby that becomes to such a great degree that it then is really truly impacting your day-to-day lives. And I think with sleep, many people, we live busy lives. Lucky for you, Mike, you seem to sleep very well, but many of us else will have, the odd night here and there where we don't sleep particularly well. And maybe, people with insomnia feel dismissed because, oh, don't we all have a bad night's sleep? But actually, there are a significant proportion of people out there who are having their lives ruined by not being able to sleep properly.
Okay, well, let's move on. It is possible to do something about this with medications derived from cannabis, but I mean, if medications derived from cannabis, people think about them in lots of different ways. I suppose my first thought is a pretty What am I? I thought that someone who, I mean, I'm not into this stuff. I don't study this. I don't take it. I don't need it. If a medication derived from cannabis helps you to sleep a bit better, are we talking sedation here, or are we talking better sleep?
So I
and
think
what's the difference?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I think a lot of the medications that are taken around, like for sleep, for example, they obviously need to have some sort of sedative property, and really it's about helping to break the cycle of poor sleep. But what you don't want to do, like we see with some sleep medications, is whilst you break the cycle of being able to get off to sleep or staying asleep, actually disrupting the quality of sleep at the same time. And so medical cannabis, because of the years of prohibition around being able to, you know, research it and study it, it's an ever-growing field. But what we do see is that, you know, in the morning after people wake up, there is a, you know, across the studies, an association of feeling refreshed in the morning, rather than potentially some of the hangover type feelings you may get with other medications like a benzodiazepine or so on and so forth.
Okay, so people will feel refreshed or report feeling refreshed with these sorts of medications.
Yeah, I think it's important to know, obviously, I'm not necessarily saying this is a panacea. This is not going to be the right option for everyone, of course. But for those people who do report a benefit, that is what we hear.
Okay, so when you say report, what do you mean? Is this one or two anecdotal reports, or is this kind of a peer-reviewed published study and a trial?
Yeah, so insomnia is one of those conditions whereby we have more trials compared to some of the other indications for medical cannabis. I think the really important thing to note is that there are certain preparations of medical cannabis that seem to perform better, and so that's why it's really important, you know, to seek it out through a legal regulated route, like through a clinic with a specialist, rather than you know, going out to the recreational or illicit market yourself. It's important to have that oversight so that someone can, you know, direct you as to what is the best preparations to use, but also you know, steer you away from any, you know, nasty things that may come contaminated with, you know, non legal cannabis.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. So there are trials mm-hmm. that have been done, and you know, I can go and find these, can I? Are they published?
Yeah, no, there are published trials, published randomized controlled trials around medical cannabis and insomnia. And then also what we've done is in the UK is set up the UK medical cannabis registry. So we've followed up people who are being prescribed medical cannabis here in the UK, and we administer validated questionnaires before they start treatment, and then at continuous time points during their times during that treatment process, and we see the change in their sleep during that time as well.
Okay, what is actually happening in the body that helps people sleep when they're using medication derived from cannabis? And is it help with THCs or CBDs? Tell us what those two and yeah, you can pronounce them. I'm not going to attempt. You can pronounce them. Tell us what the difference is, and what is actually happening when someone takes these medications and it helps them sleep. You know, why does it work? What's going on?
So, very good. So I guess to take it right back to basics. So across our bodies, we have a regulatory system called the endocannabinoid system. And really what we have is a series of receptors, molecules that act on those receptors, and then enzymes that break down those molecules that really act as a regulatory system. The endocannabinoid system often doesn't do something directly on its own. It's often acting as a brake on some of the other systems that are happening in the body. And it is really implicated in pain transmission, modulation of mood, modulation of anxiety, But then focusing specifically on sleep, because that's obviously what we're talking about today, is you have expression of the receptors in sleep-promoting parts of the brain. And so if you activate these cannabinoid receptors, and you can do that, you know, your body is doing that of its own accord on a day-to-day basis. But by taking medical cannabis, the compounds within that will act directly on those receptors. And within the context of sleep, it typically sits, there's a higher concentration, of these receptors in sleep-promoting areas of the brain. And therefore, through activation of it, we see a change in what we call the sleep-wake cycle, so your circadian rhythm. So it tends to have more of a sedating property through regulation of that.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So there's this system, what did you call it?
The endocannabinoid system.
The endocannabinoid system. Okay, so is that like, this is going to be a very basic question, which will probably prove my misunderstanding of the whole thing. So is that like, it's like the blood circulation system. It's another system. Is it as large and go throughout all our body? On, you know, is it a physical thing that is attached?
Yes, so I mean it's probably as diversely distributed as our blood system. You can find it right throughout the body, most concentrated in the brain and in the spinal cord, but it can be found on immune cells in our gut, in our skin, whatever it, you know, right across the body. But rather than being an organ system like blood and lymphatics or your gut or you know your respiratory system. Really, this is talking about more specifically things that you would see on a more microscopic level, which, like I said, acts as a regulator of mood, anxiety, sleep regulation, pain transmission, etc.
Okay. All right. So tell us a bit more about THC, CBD, what the differences are, they're molecules, I think, aren't they? You know, and they do different things in the body.
No, exactly. So THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, and CBD, cannabidiol, are the two major cannabinoids. So that's where you get that endocannabinoid derivation from, in the endo, endogenous to our own body. Cannabinoid is similar to the cannabinoids from the cannabinoid plant.
They're groups of different types of chemicals.
Yes. Yeah, so the cannabis plant actually produces a wide variety of chemicals in the flower, but the most common are these cannabinoids. And really that all that does is suggest that they actually interact with this endocannabinoid system. And there are over 140 different cannabinoids in the plant, but the two biggest ones are cannabidiol and tetrahydrocannabinol, CBD and THC. And so that's where, one, the bulk of research has been around, but then secondly, that is what is making up the majority of the effects that we see secondary to medical cannabis.
Okay. So, and which of these two is the one that causes you to get high? Because, you know, there's two different things going on here, aren't there?
Yeah. So traditionally, it is THC that causes that, that has the potential to cause an intoxicating effect. I think it's really important to make the distinction with medical cannabis. Actually, we would see that euphoria, that high, as an adverse event. That's something that we're seeking to avoid. And the way in which we do that is if you start off at a low dose, particularly of THC, and you slowly increase that over time, we see that tolerance to that adverse event happens earlier than you start to get the clinical benefits. That's why there's a titration period over about a month or so, so that we help to avoid people, we don't avoid adverse events entirely, but certainly to reduce their likelihood of occurring. Whereas CBD doesn't have the potential to cause that. And the reason for that is the way in which they interact with the endocannabinoid system is slightly different. THC is much more like a direct activator, whereas CBD acts indirectly by almost boosting our body's own cannabinoids, which then act upon those cannabinoid receptors. And it also has a number of other roles where it interacts with serotonin receptors and others in the brain, which causes its sort of more broad pharmacological action, as it were.
Okay. So the drugs you use that are derived from cannabis include both THCs and CBDs. Is that correct?
They can contain either or. It depends really on the person in front of you. So I would say for the vast majority, it will contain some of both, but there may be instances, for example, where THC is inappropriate for a patient and it obviously wouldn't be prescribed for them. I think rarely is there instances where there's nothing that contains CBD. So, that isn't really as important, but obviously there will be people for which THC is not an appropriate option.
So these decisions are made by a doctor talking to the patient, finding out exactly what the problems are, and then prescribing a drug derived from cannabis. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it's more robust than that, I would say. So first of all, a patient must submit their GP records and or a specialist records containing a confirmed diagnosis and the treatments that they've previously tried for that diagnosis. They then have to see a specialist who specializes in the condition that they have come to see them about. So someone who specializes in sleep medicine, for example, in this circumstance. They would then do their assessment. That normally will take anywhere between 30 minutes to an hour. And then they will go and discuss that case with a multidisciplinary team. It's only when that multidisciplinary team comes together, which contains other consultants in the same specialty, but also consultants in other specialties. So, for example, we normally have a pain specialist, a psychiatrist, at the very least those two, a general medicine specialist, maybe a palliative care doctor, as well as pharmacists on that call. And then together they collectively make that decision as to whether someone is suitable to be prescribed medical cannabis. And then if so, what would be the most appropriate medication to prescribe for them, balancing up all of the risks and benefits.
So that might move on to my next question, really. Once it's been prescribed, how is it taken? Is it like a pill, or do you smoke it, or what happens?
So there are a few different formats. I guess the first thing to mention off the bat is it's never to be smoked. That is still considered, well, for two reasons. One, the potential health harms, similar to tobacco, although not adulterated like some forms of some tobacco is, you are still igniting plant substance, creating smoke, creating carbon monoxide, potential carcinogens. So we would, no matter what the legal stance on it is, we would never suggest that cannabis should be smoked. And instead, medical cannabis that is in a flower format is vaporized using a medically approved vaporizer. So there are, there are technically three approved medical vaporizers, although one has just been removed from the market just because I don't think it was selling particularly well. So there's two essentially medically approved vaporizers on the UK market. And essentially you would grind the flower, put it into a small capsule, and then it heats it more gently. And what that does is it releases the active compounds without burning the plant, and therefore you don't get the production of carbon monoxide, carcinogens, etc.
All right. But you take that into your lungs. That's how it gets into your body.
Yes, exactly. You inhale it. But the other format that you may take it in is an oil format, which hold in a dropper and you place under your tongue, hold it there for 5 to 10 minutes to allow it to absorb, and then you swallow. And then there's a more novel format for people who struggle with holding an oil under their tongue, which is pastilles, which is more of a chewable one. So then you sort of chew it for 10 minutes, allow it to absorb through the lining of the mouth before swallowing. In terms of in insomnia across those formats, it will generally depend upon what that person may particularly struggle with. So for example, if a person particularly struggles with what we call sleep initiation, getting to sleep at the beginning of the night, actually that inhalation is probably a preferred method because you get much more rapid increase of the medicine into the bloodstream, and then you get clearance much quicker as well. So you're helping with that sleep initiation, but they don't need it for the rest of the night. It slowly trickles its way out of the system, basically into your urine. But otherwise, if it's more that people have trouble, they're waking up constantly in the night, then maybe one of those longer acting formats like an oil or a pastille may be more appropriate. Okay. Because it takes longer to take effect, but it stays present at a lower level in the bloodstream.
All right. Can we move on to sort of sleep itself? Now, we spoke about sort of the quality of the sleep and how people tend to wake up refreshed. What about the type of sleep? Because I know people talk about the different types of sleep and how different types of sleep are important. What got me thinking about this actually was wondering if the sort of dreams that people have change, because people dream in different types of sleep. You know, there's REM sleep and deep sleep and all that sort of thing. Has any work been done on whether people have different types of sleep or a greater quantity of different types of sleep than sleep that just happens naturally?
Yeah, so this is more of an evolving area rather than something that is more well understood. But certainly there are more studies that are seeking to look at how the different, like as you mentioned, you have your REM sleep and then you have your three different stages of non-REM sleep, how they are changed through the night. I guess in terms of looking at the data from the UK Medical Cannabis Registry, for example, there are a few individuals, although rare, who report sort of more vivid dreams. That is something that does come through in the adverse event data from the UK Medical Cannabis Registry. But on the flip side, there are also a number of people who are captured in that who live with PTSD, and actually for them, they notice not necessarily a reduction in the vivaciousness of their dreams, for lack of a better term, but I guess like a change in the content in terms of reducing the night terrors that they may necessarily get. Right.
Okay. So dreams might become more vivid. Is that sort of anecdotal, or has that happened to a lot of people? Or
So it's not anecdotal. We've captured it in, you know, an ethically approved study in the UK Medical Cannabis Registry, but it's certainly not a commonly reported adverse event. That also, you know, we're talking in the regions of sort of, you know, 1 in 100 or so, okay, rather than it being, you know, particularly common. But, you know, it's something that we see.
Yeah, all right. Are there any other things that you see that might be classed as risks?
Yeah, so the typical adverse event profile across the UK Medical Cannabis Registry is sort of between 10 to 20% of individuals will tend to report an adverse event. Most commonly, that will tend to be as they're initiating treatment, and most of them tend to subside. The most common ones that we see are things such as dry mouth, fatigue, somnolence, so sleepiness. So maybe in those individuals who are finding it difficult to sleep, that may be more of a desired effect rather than an adverse event, but for others it's obviously an adverse event. And then some people may find difficulties with concentration or motivation or whatever. Those are sort of the top five adverse events that we see across the UK medical cannabis registry.
I mean, if people are using these sorts of drugs, well, for anything, but I suppose specifically for sleep, as soon as that's what we're talking about now, do people find that they need to take more of it to get the same effect? Do they work up a tolerance?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's something that we've been really interested in looking at, because we know that with more administration of the compounds contained within medical cannabis, particularly the THC, you do tend to get some downregulation of those cannabinoid receptors. And then how does that feed into what happens on a clinical basis? What we tend to see is actually that there is some tolerance within the first 1 to 3 months. And then actually, what that does is it allows us to build up the dose whilst we're hopefully minimizing those adverse events. But then what you see is actually, rather than the dose continuing to trend upwards, you see a plateauing. So we almost use some of that tolerance to our benefit when starting treatment, in that we increase it slowly so that people gain tolerance to maybe some of the adverse events that I mentioned, like the sleepiness, like the fatigue, like the dry mouth. But we don't see that people need to continuously take higher and higher in doses to achieve the same effect.
Okay. Well, that's probably a good thing. You spoke about the process to actually get these things prescribed, you know, how it's quite lengthy and you have to go through quite long chats, whatever you would call them. I don't know, you probably don't call them chats, but there's a process to talk to a doctor to get prescribed these things. Is there anyone that should absolutely not be using these sorts of medications?
Yeah, we definitely have some sort of hard line in the sand in terms of who can be prescribed this. So anyone who is pregnant or currently breastfeeding shouldn't be prescribed medical cannabis. Also those individuals who have uncontrolled heart conditions. So they have, so if you have previously had a heart attack, but it's now well controlled, you don't have any chest pain, then that's absolutely fine. But if you are currently having intermittent chest pain, then it's not appropriate for you. And then the other thing is for individuals with psychosis. If you have psychosis, and particularly individuals where that tends to be exacerbated by cannabis use in the past, then that would certainly be a reason not to prescribe for an individual as well.
Okay. And does that happen fairly often? That's probably an impossible question, but is that like 1 in 10 potential patients, 1 in 100, or?
Who have those reasons not to prescribe?
Yeah,
any.
Yeah.
So because what we do is before we even see patients, we get their medical records. So actually almost they're filtered out before they even get to the consultation stage. And then if they do, they'll then be seen by another specialist who then reads them and then goes through the history with the patient. So actually it's very infrequent that they would even get through to a consultation, just because of the rigor that our clinical triaging team take.
Okay. So, I mean, that's something that's really worth just talking about, the rigor of your consultation team, because medication derived from cannabis is now very popular. You know, it's everywhere on social media, on the internet. I would hope that this is taken very seriously and it's not just dished out to anyone.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think that although there's, obviously things out there that are sort of beyond our control, what we can always control is the way in which we, put in our clinical processes to make sure that people have a good experience, but at the same time, we are making sure that they are a suitable candidate for medical cannabis. And whilst they're being prescribed medical cannabis, they're having appropriate follow-up, a minimum every 3 months, more frequently at the beginning, to make sure that, the medication continues to be working for them and isn't causing any, longer-term adverse events or anything like that.
Very good. All right. So largely we've been talking about poor sleep and helping people with poor sleep. If someone has poor sleep for a night or two, or even if they have poor sleep for longer, say a month, what would your advice, your initial advice to them be?
So I think if it's more of that shorter term poor sleep, the key things is around that sleep hygiene. So try and set a regular time that you're going to bed and a regular time that you wake up. And even if you're feeling sleepy in the morning, do get up at that regular bedtime. Don't hit the snooze alarm like we're all tempted to do from time to time, because actually then what you're doing is you're creating that sleep debt. And then when you go to bed the next night, it's going to be much easier for you to then fall asleep if you're keeping that regular bedtime and then wake time. Other common things that people do wrong is when they wake up in the night, they may get, you know, have the, go to their phone, you know, which is like nice, bright, stimulating light, lots of interesting things on there. But at the same time, that's helping to keep you awake. And at the same time, screens right before bedtime, really, it's not just the bright light, it's all of the engaging things on there that are getting your brain whirring rather than falling asleep. So I would say, you know, if you can, phones out of the bedroom as best possible. If you need an alarm, go back to a traditional alarm clock. You know, you won't be tempted to have a look at it. Other things that people do is they may have their phone out of their bedroom, but they're tossing and turning. They're like, you know, they're getting frustrated. Why am I not getting back to sleep? If that's happening to you and it, you know, that's going on for 10, 15, 20 minutes, then get out of bed, go and do a non-stimulating activity in low light, such as reading a book or whatever else may take your fancy. Obviously not on a screen. And again, what that's doing is helping to reframe what the bed is for you. It's not a place where you don't get sleep and you're restless and you're agitated. It's a place where you go back to where you feel sleep. So when you know, you're reading a book or whatever other activity it is, you start to feel sleepy again. That's the point when you go back to sleep. But let's say this is, you know, you've been doing that, things have progressed, this has now been your circumstance for a few months or so. It's really impacting your day-to-day life. What's the next step? The next step at that point would be to go and see your GP, and they'll be able to offer you access to what we call cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, CBTI. So what that does is it incorporates some of those best sleep hygiene measures, as well as some other sort of traditional aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy. So reframing sort of your thoughts around sleep, because people, if they have that going on a long time, start to build up some sort of anxiety around going to bed and what bedtime is going to be like for them, as well as some other things. So more intensive measures. So I talked about a regular sleep and wake time. When you go through CBTI, what you'll start to do is start to do some like sleep restriction. So actually you'll be trying to essentially aim for around about 85% of your time in bed is when you're asleep. And if you're not hitting that, then actually you're going to be pushing your bedtime later, pushing your wake time earlier until you reach that, and then slowly stretching that back out to a normal wake time so that your body learns essentially that your bedroom and your bed is positive for sleep. So those are the first measures. And then obviously if those haven't been beneficial, that is at the point when to consider medications beyond that.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. One final thing. If people are listening to this and would like to have a source of information that they can go away and look at, good, sensible, balanced information about sleep help, possibly even medication to help them sleep, can you suggest a couple of good, sensible resources?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the places that I always, for everything, send people to are things like the NHS website. Patient UK is also really helpful resource. There's often led by, her name escapes me, but the lady who's often on with Jeremy Vine and Radio 2, that they're often very good accessible resources. If people want to find out more specifically about like the medical cannabis aspect of what we've talked about, if you go to curativeclinic.com, every week I do a research blog. Some of them will be about sleep, some of them will be about other activities. We also have the associated research that sort of prompted this conversation today, as well as some other things on there as well.
Excellent. So, look, Simon, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat. We'd ran out of time to talk about your PhD studies in particular, so maybe I'll have to invite you back in a few months when you've written it up.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, thanks. But either way, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat.
Cheers. You too.
Many thanks to my guest on this week's show. That was Dr. Simon Erridge of Curaleaf, talking about cannabis-derived medicines and how they can help with people who find it very difficult to sleep. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week. Until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.